May it please the court, counsel Brian Woodward on behalf of the defendant Ricky Scott. Your honors are once again called upon to walk down the path. It seems that we have to examine every state statute that involves a criminal violation to determine whether or not that violation may constitute a violent felony when the defendant is charged in federal court and subject to an enhanced sentence under the Armed Career Criminal Act.
Is there any dispute as to whether the intimidation conviction was for a Class C felony?
No.
So then isn't it clearly for a violent felony because it necessarily includes, drawing or using a deadly weapon while communicating a threat with the intent that the other person be placed in fear of retaliation? And doesn't the drawing or use of the weapon while communicating that threat render it a violent felony?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and this is why I don't believe so. And I think before we analyze the statute under the modified categorical approach, we have to look back to this court's opinion in Ellis, which analyzed Indiana's intimidation statute under the categorical approach and determined that it wasn't a violent felony under the first prong of the definition.
But if it's divisible, and if by the time you get to the statutory language of the Class C felony, you can see that it describes something that poses a substantial risk of harm to someone, the person draws or uses a deadly weapon, why not under the modified categorical approach that we've elaborated, does that not satisfy the rule?
I think, Your Honor, under the, I'll call it an algorithm that the courts put in place that you make certain determinations to determine, yes, it is a crime of violence or no, it is not. I think what the next step in the analysis, after we look at all the charging document, the plea colloquy, if there is one, the stipulated factual basis.
Which, by the way, here, he stipulates that he said, you are a marked man, I'm going to kill you as soon as I get a chance. This isn't a contested fact. It's a stipulation.
No, but once again, under the analysis as set forth by the Supreme Court in Begay and Shepard, the underlying facts are not pertinent to determine whether or not it's a crime of violence, but
they're
only to determine...
Put it in, right, in a box in the statute, but that takes us to the Class C felony.
Which we know. So there's no need to look at the underlying facts in this case because we know what portion of the statute's been violated.
Well, can we go on with what my sister just noted? They get to the police station, and he's repeating the threat. He's telling the officer to remove his handcuffs so that, he can kick him somewhere that I will not mention. And as he's being uncuffed, he's pulling out a pocket knife and lunging at the officer. And he stipulates to all of this. I mean, for heaven's sakes.
Well, I think the trap that we all fall into is we want to look at the underlying conduct to determine whether or not the defendant's actions at that particular time constituted a violent felony as defined under the second prong of the violent felony definition. That we cannot do. We know which section of the statute was violated in this case. There's no need to delve into that analysis to say what did he do or what did he not do. What we do know is this court has determined in Ellis that there's no element within the intimidation statute. And by the way, we're talking about, except for the C felony enhancement, we're talking about the same exact subsections of the intimidation statute that Ellis violated in relation to what Ricky Scott violated. They were the same subsections.
But I want to go back to the...
We don't have to stop, with Ellis, there's Riskiewicz, a threat to injure a couple with the presence of a deadly weapon surely raises the threat of force that would cause physical pain or injury. We go on from Ellis.
I think these underlying facts tell us further with the divisible statute. I'm looking at the Indiana statute. Section 1B2 gets you into the Class C felony, so that tells you the person draws or uses a deadly weapon. And the underlying facts also tell us that this threat was one unlawfully to injure the person threatened. It's not just unlawfully withholding official action or exposing somebody to hatred or something like that. We get to look at the underlying facts to figure out which part of the statute has been violated.
And we know, pursuant to Ellis, that unlawfully injure means non-physical or perhaps physical injuries, non-physical injuries.
With a deadly weapon? I don't know.
And with regard to the conviction for criminal recklessness, can't we look at the factual basis for the guilty plea to determine whether he pled to intentional rather than reckless conduct? I mean, surely it cannot be your contention that firing 6 shots at a person could be reckless rather than intentional conduct, or that approaching a victim and kicking him so severely that he breaks a bone in his shoulder and causes a loss of consciousness, that's reckless conduct by you?
I don't think we can determine, based upon the status of the record and what the Supreme Court tells us, the facts that we can find, based upon, yes, the answer to your question is yes, we can look at those documents. But what we don't have here, again, we're looking at those documents to determine what part of the statute was violated. Again, it's tempting to look at the facts and draw the conclusion that there's intent. But what you have to do, there's no specific finding either in the information charging document itself or in the stipulated factual basis that Mr. Scott acted with intent. The only way you can get to that finding that he acted with intent or purposefully under the second prong of the analysis is to do some independent divining, deduction, inference that these actions infer or deduce intent.
So kicking someone in the... just kicking someone to the point of unconsciousness, I can't tell that his intent... I have to stop and think, was that reckless intent?
Well, don't forget, in this particular case, the stipulated factual basis does not say that Mr. Scott is the one that did all of the kicking or even kicked more than one time. We can't tell by looking at the stipulated factual basis in this particular case because it says he, along with 3 others, entered the jail cell of another individual. We don't know if he kicked once, if he kicked twice. We don't know if he did all the kicking or we know he kicked one time. We don't know where he kicked. We don't know if he kicked, in his head, in his shoulder, in his legs. We don't even know if he made contact. We just know he was there and engaged in this with 3 other individuals. Seems I've exhausted.
You're in your
room. Exhausted.
my 8 minutes already, so we had a lot of ground to cover, so I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Kirchhoff, it's your third time today?
Second. May it please the court, counsel. Emily Kirchhoff on behalf of the United States. All 3 of Mr. Scott's prior felony convictions are for violent felonies under the Armed Career Criminal Act. Looking first at his 1994 criminal recklessness conviction, under this court's decision in Clinton, you can look at the stipulated facts and the plea agreement to determine whether Mr. Scott acted knowing, reckless, or intentional. And the facts, as he admitted to them, are that he approached the victim, fired a handgun in his direction 6 times. And we believe that that conduct shows an intentional act and intent as to the consequences of a substantial risk of bodily injury.
So which subpart of the Indiana statute are you saying that? Because we have to look at these factual details for purposes of picking a statutory part, not just because of what they did.
Correct. We believe that it is Indiana Code 3542.22, subsection B1, and then also the C2A, which makes it a Class D felony because he was armed with a deadly weapon.
Okay.
And I think the language that is at issue is the recklessly, knowingly, or intentionally aspect of subsection B1.
Mm-hmm.
And under...
So there's no chance that he fired this gun recklessly?
Under the facts as he admitted them, no. It's the fact that he approached the victim, shot in the victim's direction 6 times. In fact, at the sentencing hearing, he admitted that he was doing that to let them know that he was armed. So he wanted to create a substantial risk of bodily injury. Likewise,
I mean, he could have been reckless. He could have been shooting in the victim's direction, thinking that he was such a great shot, he was just going to scare this person to death, but not actually hit them. I mean, I don't even know if he did hit the victim, but, you know, he thinks he's William Tell or something. He's going to shoot the apple off the head.
That is a possibility, but I think it is equally possible that he was shooting to scare them off and to let them know that he was not going to just kind of stand there and be a victim himself. And I believe that is the characterization of the facts as he admitted to them. His second prior conviction for the intimidation, we believe that the addition of the, as this court mentioned, subsection B2 that stated that he committed the felony while armed with a deadly weapon makes this case very much like this court's decision in Taylor and distinguishes the Ellis decision. He was armed with a deadly weapon at the time he communicated the threat, which does fall under that element definition as presenting at least a threatened use of physical force. And in the alternative, this conviction could also qualify under that residual clause as an act that creates a substantial risk of physical injury in itself because of the presence of the deadly weapon at the time the threat was communicated. And finally, with the third conviction, the 1995 conviction for criminal recklessness, once again, we believe that the facts that the defendant admitted to show that he acted with intent. He admits to not only approaching the victim himself, but also with three other individuals, and approaching one person, outnumbering them that way, and kicking them shows an intent that bodily injury will result. And so it is the government's position that all three of these prior convictions qualify as violent felonies, therefore making the application of the Armed Career Criminal Act appropriate in this case. And if there are no further questions, the government requests that the district court affirm, or this court affirm the district court sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grubhoff. Mr. Woodward?
Just two issues, Your Honors. As it pertains to divining intent, I'm not aware of any case, either in this circuit or in the Supreme Court, which says we can look at the underlying facts of a case as set forth in a plea colloquy, in a charging document, or in a stipulated factual basis, and from those facts divine what specific intent or mens rea was required or was exercised, as a matter of fact, just by looking at those documents. That is what Apprendi prohibits. That's what the Supreme Court prohibited in Taylor and Shepard and Begay and all those cases. In order, even if it's divisible, it would have had to have said in the stipulated factual basis that acting with intent, he did the following. Or perhaps it would have said acting recklessly, he did the following.
We can't use any common sense about, you know, some things that might happen either recklessly or intentionally, and other things that it's just, you know, like the kicking, impossible to imagine how you could accidentally be standing there kicking someone or recklessly standing there kicking someone.
When we're talking about a mental state, that's a fact-finding process. That's a function for a jury. It's not a function for a court, sentencing court to exercise sitting there. So we're requesting that you reverse and remand this for resentencing, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Woodward. And you were court appointed?
I was court appointed.
Thank you very much for taking the case and for vigorous representation of your client. Thank you.
Let me say that 25 years ago, not to the date, but roughly, I first appeared in federal courts in Hammond, Indiana, and was before Your Honor. So that was 25 years ago. It's a pleasure to be back.
Happy anniversary to the two of you.
Thank you, Mr. Woodward. All right. Okay, well, with that, court will be in recess until tomorrow.